Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everybody. This is Renee. Welcome back to Renee's Heart to Heart. Well, I hope everybody's New Year's Eve and New Year's Day were filled with lots of good thoughts for the future and family and friends and comfort. Places that make you feel like you're where you're supposed to be when you're there. I spent my time with my family. No family that lives outside of our house, but that's still quite a few people. We had a great dinner yesterday, and then my kids went crazy for me to make some fudge. Around my house, it's called the Fat Fix. So I make homemade fudge with peanut butter in it, and they put it over ice cream. So not very good for the New Year's plan to watch what you eat. However, that's the way the Brewer family ended New Year's Day. But it was nice, and it was good to have everybody here and a nice quiet evening with all of us. I hope you all were able to do the same. I first would like to touch base. I'm going to bring Shelley in first because I want to catch us all up with the stuff that's going on with the young girl that is supposedly, according to all the powers that be, brain dead after a tonsillectomy. Good morning, Shell. How are you?
Good morning, Rainey.
Everything okay?
Yeah. Had a nice good day, relaxing. Didn't do a lot yesterday. Mm-hmm. I played, as I said before, like on Christmas Day, my mom really likes games and stuff, so we had a couple of rounds of card games and stuff like that. So it was just kind of a nice veg day. And kind of getting myself ready for next week, which is going to be very hectic for me. So I just kind of built up my energy a little bit.
Well, good. Good. Well, that's important to do, too. We also did that. It was the last today. All the decorations are coming down, so I had everything ablaze with Christmas lights all day, and we did a lot of that. Watched TV, just hung out. I got up early in the morning and made pancakes for everybody. So I guess yesterday was a big eating day when I stop and think about everything that everybody ate all day. But it was nice, and it's nice to have everybody together. I wanted to catch everybody up with what's going on with the little girl that has been proclaimed brain dead. And still so much controversy regarding all of the things that are going on with her. The latest, as of last night, they're trying to find, for whatever reasons, the hospital won't send the apparatus that she's on, the ventilator that she's on, with her to this hospital in New York. So they're trying to find somebody now who will actually replace the ventilator, which sounds incredibly dangerous to me, and kind of small-minded as well, to send this young woman into a hospital that has offered to let her be there for a while until they're absolutely positively sure that all of the prognosis and analysis of what's going on in her are really the truth. Right. And according to some of the stories I read last night, she actually responds and moves when her mom talks to her and stuff like that. So now, whether or not that is, journalistic fairy tales, which is possible, because a lot of times if somebody's in a comatose state, brain dead, I've never been around with somebody who's been diagnosed like that. Except for a very long time ago, I was around somebody who had been proclaimed brain dead, but he was an older guy, and when they took him off life support, he only lasted 3 more minutes. So there was no movement. There was no interaction whatsoever. But a 13-year-old, you know, let's face it, a 13-year-old's connectivity and a 60-year-old's connectivity are probably two different things. So,
yeah.
But the greatest difference, I think, that has been made is there's still lots of controversy, and a few of the respite homes or whatever they were, they don't give names of them, that were involved in the very beginning have reneged on their offers. And
but there's still one that's staying with their offers?
Yes, there's still one in New York, but now they're trying to find somebody who will actually make the move. Now, what I know about
why the existing hospital just won't leave her on that ventilator, and they just haven't sent the equipment back once they transfer her over. It's like they're trying to make this as difficult as possible.
Well, I think, again, it's political, because you have to remember that they're putting their doctors, their authoritative figures in the world of health and welfare, in a kind of a bad place. So even though I don't agree with them, I have a little bit of understanding for why they're behaving the way they are. It's truly what they believe. So you can't, at least I can't, fault somebody in believing in what they say.
I don't agree with that, because I think I think there's other reasons that are political that have nothing to do with being righteous. Because I'm not so sure that I'm comfortable with some of the other behavior, and it's more like they're trying to discourage anybody. Maybe they don't want anybody to really have access to her physiology or seeing what condition she's in. I'm very suspect of the hospital's behavior, I have to be honest with you.
Well, and I don't disagree with that. I'm just trying to keep both sides of this issue open. And part of me, obviously, I've already stated that, feels that way very strongly. But, you know, I am a Libra, and I always can see something on the other side that has a little bit of merit, and that's it. That's what I see on the other side, the fact that people who have been trained in this arena, people who are, I'm sure, none of them are 22 years old that are making all these calls. They're people that are respected and do this for a living. So part of me has to have, I don't know, a little bit of respect for what they're saying. And again, doesn't mean I have to believe them, but what do I know at the end of the day? Not a damn thing about this.
Right.
So I'm just trying to show both sides of the story. And I do think there is a much bigger story than we don't know about. In that respect, I'm sure you're completely right. And you and I both know, just from the things that have happened in our own lives, that things are not always what they seem. And
right.
When the media is involved, we've also talked about this at length, you often only hear what the media is privy to. And what the media doesn't hear, they often fill in the spaces. So, you know, it is what it is. But something is screwy. Do you really believe in your heart of hearts? Now think about this and dig really deep. Do you really believe that if there was a chance that a 13-year-old child with all of this media and all of this controversy and everything would survive, do you really think that people who take the Hippocratic Oath and really who believe in what they're doing and have made it to the top of their field would not want this girl to survive? Do you really believe that?
If there was something that they did that was an error during her surgery, like they screwed up on her anesthesia or something like that, the answer is yes. Because
okay, really think that the people are given
fearful that she may have permanent, let's say they're fearful she could recover but have permanent brain damage. I mean, that's a huge consequence to them. And based on a couple of the shows I saw that were documentaries, where officials made decisions based on money, not based on whether someone was going to survive or not. A lot of times a pending lawsuit or something like that makes them make a decision that has nothing to do with the potential survival of the patient.
So you believe pretty much that the power, first of all, it's very unlikely that the powers that be that are making these calls are not the same team that did the surgery and were involved in it from the get-go. There's that assumption to be made. Not necessarily
I don't know.
True.
I always thought that those decisions were taken out of the team's hands, and it goes into administrators that really weren't even present when anything was happening, and that now they're just in cover-your-butt mode.
Hmm. Well, so...
That's what happened on a few of the shows I watched, is that the doctors were sort of taken out of the loop, and it was in administrators' hands that were just bean counters, basically.
Well,
I don't know if that's what's happening here, but I'm just saying that the couple of episodes I saw on that show, Untold Stories of the ER, where the doctors were so frustrated because they were being hampered by administrators, which had nothing to do with the medical. They had very sound medical decision, and they weren't permitted to do things. Like I told you, the one guy had to go against what the administrators say in order to save his woman's life, and it was a given. By doing it, the only action that was going to save this woman's life was getting the anti-venom for the snake bite, and the administrator actually told him he wasn't permitted to do so, and that if he did it, his job would be on the line, and he did it anyway. I mean, here this was a healthy woman. She was in her late 30s. There was no chance she was not going to survive. She was already recovering with the amount of anti-venom they gave her so far, and then he wouldn't let him go out of their network because it would cost them money. And meanwhile, the woman had insurance. I don't know what the administrator was upset about anyway, but I guess they made less of a profit if they went outside their network. It was a very expensive shot, and she needed like 8 more.
Mm-hmm. Well, and of course, that's what hurts all of our feelings, is the fact that when something gets to this level of, politics again and controversy, then decisions are made for all the wrong reasons.
Right.
We don't disagree about that at all. I just always believe that there's always more than one and sometimes more than two sides of a story. And I still explain, and again, I read like 4 more articles this weekend or this yesterday when we didn't do the show yesterday morning. I got up really early anyway and went online to see if there was any more information. And the change with the ventilator and all that stuff happens like midday. So I read all these different stories, and that's how I found the story of how the mom said, you know, how can somebody who is brain dead react to my voice?
Right,
these are not
right.
Spasms. They're not involuntary movements. I come in and I talk and I touch her and she moves. And, you know, I don't believe that she's not in there someplace. And, of course, I would feel exactly the same way. But that's the first time I've read anything like that. And I saw a lot of pictures and things like that of the family gathering and everybody, you know, standing together. And, of course, having been there a couple times in my life, I certainly appreciate what the family is going through, but I'm trying to understand what the other side of the story is. I'm really trying to fish for an answer as to why this is the behavior that we're watching. It doesn't make sense to me that if you became a doctor or even the administrator in an important hospital, isn't what you fight for is life?
That's right.
That's what's, you know, something is either being avoided, I'm going to use that terminology instead of covered up, because they fear the outcome, or something else is going on. But whatever it is, it's much deeper than the rest of us are being given information about. So we will
keep...
Yeah, we will keep following this story, but you and I could debate it until, I don't know, until I'm 70 and you're 60, I think. So I did want to do a story today again on drugs. I have mentioned on the show now a couple times that I just recently became affiliated with a women's green sober house here in Loxahatchee, and I will be the director, the manager, whatever you want to call or whatever I want to call myself, the mother, the den mother, whatever, of this house, and I am very excited about it. But it's in my research to actually know what I'm doing in a house like this, I found lots of interesting facts about alcoholism, drug use, all the things that we've discussed on this show many, many times. And I think you and I, in particular, have become a bit more knowledgeable about the different choices that are out there. I remember in the very beginning, we've almost been on the air now for a year, and in the very beginning, we were struggling trying to find proper places, and we were concerned about how much help was available out there. We know now that there's a lot of help, but in most cases, as usual, money is the key. How much help you get, what caliber of help you get, you know, what the transition is for you if you are really, really hooked on some of these horrendous prescription drugs. That seems to be one of the worst maladies out there today, the people that are hooked on oxycodone and Oxycontin, and even things like, what's the name, the one that they give everybody to keep them calm. We have a lot of older friends that use Xanax. We have a lot of them.
Yeah. And the literature I'm reading from some of the organizations that have been developed to help people to not, you know, be over-medicated, is that all these drugs, any painkillers and any antidepressants, have just a litany of side effects, and I don't think people are properly prepared to deal with the side effects. A lot of them are unprepared. I mean, even though you hear these commercials on TV all the time and it gives all the different side effects, I think people ignore that because they think they're the exception to the rule, and that's not the case. So people, a lot of times when they start having a reaction, you know, because the doctors are so nonchalant when they prescribe these drugs, I don't think they adequately warn people how addictive they can become and of all the different side effects. And, you know, a lot of people get really messed up. They'll start taking an antidepressant, and then the next thing they know, they're feeling suicidal. And they don't realize it's from the antidepressant, you know. So it's unfortunate that, you know, that people are very trusting of the medical profession of providing a solution for them. And a lot of times the pharmaceutical issue is not there. And these people get addicted, and it changes their personality. And then they can't function. They can't function on their job. They can't function in relationships. And it just leads from one drug to the next, because now they have to take a drug to counteract the effect of the first drug. And it ends up putting them in this, like, downward spiral. And unless they take control themselves and say, wow, there has to be a different option, they get pulled in by the pill mill, so to speak.
Mm-hmm. Well, and because, and we've talked about this at length, everybody's looking for the quick fix. And
Right. Everybody
wants comfort and wants a feeling of, well, not just happiness, but I don't think they're looking for to be stoned all the time. I don't think that's necessarily the level of the word I want, of relief that they want. I think that they just want to be copacetic. I think that they want to be able to function on some kind of a level without all the anxiety that is in our world today. We talked so many times about why people turn to chemicals to put themselves in a happier space, in a more...
Well, remember what I was telling you, and this makes a lot of sense, because I had had a best friend for 12 years who, when I first met her, I didn't know it, but she had been a heroin addict when she was younger. She got herself clean, remained clean for 20 years, until some stuff started happening to her at work again, and she met somebody who was a cocaine dealer, got her back on cocaine, and she thought because she had been clean for 20 years that she could control it, and it doesn't happen that way. And if you have an addictive physiology, and it is a physiology, you're always going to be an addict. And she became addicted again, and it took her like a year and a half to get back on heroin. But the problem with somebody who has an addictive personality, and what I mean by that is genetically, is that they never feel okay. God, my animals, one's sneezing and one's meowing here. Hang on a second.
Well, I think the point Shelley's trying to make is...
Right, I'm back. What I'm saying, and I'll make this quick so we can continue, what I'm saying is that people who have an addictive physiology, maybe with this genetic defect that I was talking about, the A1 allele dopamine mm-hmm. receptor, people that have that, and a true addict has that, okay? They never feel okay. So even when nothing is going wrong in their life, they don't feel okay. They always have that sense like something's wrong. So the reason they turn to alcohol or drugs, like you said, it's not that they want to feel high all the time. It's that they feel good. They feel in power. They're not high. They're not looking to get, like you said, they're not trying to feel like they're drunk, although a lot of times they go that far. What they're trying to achieve is feeling some happiness or some excitement about life, because they don't feel that way when they're not medicated or when they don't have alcohol or drugs in their system. By fixing that problem, then, like I told you, this college talks about amino acid therapy and things that will balance the brain chemistry so that they can have normal responses but without pharmaceuticals, okay, because we're talking about supplementation, things that make the brain act, you know, brain chemistry fixes, but non-pharmaceutical brain chemistry fixes. This allows these people to have normal emotional reactions to things without having to have any drugs in their system and or any alcohol in their system. And what they're searching for is to have a normal range of emotions. And most people that are addicts don't. They always have a sense of dread or discontent with their life, even when things are going perfectly okay. And can you imagine walking around feeling like that all the time? You know, even when things are going wrong in my life, I can maintain some level of hope and feeling okay. But can you imagine living a life and actually having things work out for you and still having this sense of dread? It must be awful to live that way. And that's what happens to people that are addictive.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think everybody has a little bit of anxiety or a little bit of discomfort when things aren't exactly the way their mind, their upbringing, their environment teaches them that they're supposed to be. And when there's any variables there, they get anxious and they almost get fearful about the fact that they don't think that they're functioning the way they should be, because they are watching everybody else and wondering why they're different. There's lots of things that go through our heads that can be our demise, without a shadow of a doubt. But I think one of the things that I really wanted to talk about today is the use of drugs and different kinds of euphorias that people are looking for that are really attacking again our young people. And of course the long-term ramifications of starting to use drugs or alcohol when you're 12 are great, much greater than if you wait to be, you know, an adult and start making choices like that. That's one thing. But when you start needing that that you have that dependency on something other than yourself, the repercussions are great, and it hampers everything you do, the decisions you make about who you want to spend time with, the decisions you make about how you feel about yourself and your own personal health. All those things now are on a bad downhill slant. And that's what scares me more than anything. Experimentation with getting drunk one night when you're 13 and then it never happening again, in some cases, is a good thing. But not getting drunk, not getting sick, but having a few drinks several times in the span of a year, what are you doing? What are you doing? You're teaching yourself that you can handle those things. So then, consequently, you have a bad dependency because now you think you're in charge of it. And that's the worst thing that can happen to these kids. And everything I read now, well, I found this really, it was a good site. It's managed by the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and it's Facts for Families About Teens with Alcohol and Other Drugs. And it says experimentation with alcohol and drugs during adolescence is common. Well, we all get that. Unfortunately, teenagers often don't see the link between their actions today. Now, this sentence I hope we are all listening to. I don't care whether you're 16 or 60. Unfortunately, teenagers often don't see the link between their actions today and the consequences tomorrow. They also have a tendency to feel indestructible and immune to the problems that others experience. Now, those two sentences are more true than the color black and the color white, are they not?
Well, yeah, of course, because kids feel that no matter what they do, they're resilient, they're going to bounce back from it. You know, children feel immortal. They because they're so young, they're so healthy and vibrant, they don't tap into the mortality of us. They don't understand that although our bodies are strong, we're also fragile at the same time. You know, you got to take care of the body and the mind and the brain. So they'll make choices out of curiosity. They'll make choices out of wanting to be a little daring and try something new without really thinking about the what ifs, you know, the potential consequences. And if something bad happened to somebody else, well, that person must have done something wrong. You know, that they rationalize it because they don't believe that that it's a real risk. They believe that the other person was just weaker or got bad stuff or whatever. I've heard some of the arguments. You know, they don't look at the reality behind the risks they're taking. You know, and an old thing, you know, drugs, you know, trying risky, you know, things when they're out and all that. One of the other things, I don't know, it might be in this article that you're reading from. Do they talk about the fact that the brain, there's a sheath around the brain that protects you? It's like it forms a blood-brain barrier. And I think it's not completely developed until you're like 20 or 21 or something like that. That's another reason why it's actually more dangerous for children or teenagers to try drugs and alcohol, because the susceptibility for them to have negative reactions to it and to become addicted is much higher than an adult, because their brain actually hasn't completely formed yet this protective sheath around it.
Well, I didn't read anything like that in here. But I have read that before, and I think that there's a lot of contributing factors to why this turns into what it turns into. And of course, maturity, with or without a sheath around your brain, the maturity on its own lends itself to poor decisions and in the end, repercussions. What tomorrow brings, you start altering with the drugs and the alcohol. So let me read some more of this. Using alcohol and tobacco at a young age has negative health effects. Some teens will experiment and stop, or continue to use occasionally without significant problems. Others will develop a dependency, moving on to more dangerous drugs and causing significant harm to themselves and possibly others. It's difficult to know which teens will experiment and stop and which will develop serious problems. And, of course, I think heredity and lifestyle and what they're immersed in has a lot to do with those things. Teenagers at risk for developing serious alcohol and drug problems include these. Now, this is what I just talked about. With a family history of substance use disorders, those who are depressed, those who have low self-esteem, and who feel like they don't fit in or out of the mainstream. Fitting in, I'm sure, is a big contender in the reasons for why anybody gets involved in this. I know, I think that's true of all of us. Even at my age, that can be true. Teenagers abuse a variety of drugs, both legal and illegal. Legally available drugs include alcohol, prescribed medications, inhalants, fumes from glues, aerosols, and solvents, and over-the-counter cough, cold, sleep, and diet medications. The most commonly used illegal drugs are, of course, marijuana, and then stimulants like cocaine, crack, and speed, LSD, PCP, opiates, heroin, and designer drugs like ecstasy. The use of illegal drugs is increasing, especially among young teens. The average age of the first marijuana use is 14, and alcohol use can start before the age of 12. The use of marijuana and alcohol in high school has become very, very common. Drug use is associated with a variety of negative consequences, including increased risk of serious drug use later in life, school failure, the poor judgment, which may put teens at risk for accidents, violence, unplanned and unsafe sex, and suicide. Parents can prevent their children from using drugs by talking to them about drugs, open communication, role modeling, responsible behavior, and recognizing if problems are developing. Now, I find this to be a little, this part of this article to be a little Pollyanna, and I would say to you that if you have any questions about this and if you are not sure as to what to do, you need to seek some professional help. And I realize that today what I thought would stay with schools forever were counselors. As a teenager in my high school and in my middle school, there were always counselors. Each grade, like if you were in seventh grade, you had these three specific counselors. If you were in eighth grade, you had three different ones. If you were in ninth grade, you had three different ones. That's the way the school was when I was a kid, many, 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 many years ago. However, now they have what they call vice principals. They're not referred to as counselors, and very sadly, from what I'm understanding and seeing, they really don't counsel. They're what we used to call the dean. The dean is who you went to if you were misbehaving or did something bad. Then the dean was in charge of your punishment. And now that seems to be what's concentrated on the best. So if a kid is having problems, if they don't have a favorite teacher, which happens sometimes, thank you to those teachers out there that realize they have a kid in their class that needs their attention, then they often don't have that kind of a place to go to. So I think this can be an issue. But if you're a parent and you know that something's wrong, that's one of the first things you should be doing is finding somebody for this child to talk to, even if it's another friend, enlist the help of another friend. Talking is incredibly medicinal, and I don't know why we don't understand that better than what we do. It's the warning. Now, this is another thing that I find to be amusing because I don't think that this is necessarily right on. Warning signs of teenage alcohol and drug abuse may include fatigue, repeated health complaints, red and glazed eyes, and a lasting cough. Emotional, personality change, sudden mood changes, irritability, irresponsible behavior, low self-esteem, poor judgment, depression, and general lack of interest. I want to add something to that. I want to add, irritability. I want to say anger. If you have a 15, 16-year-old who just seems to be pissed off all the time, I mean angry, you need mm-hmm. to talk to them and find out what's going on. Because I'm telling you, they're either fighting, doing what everybody else is doing, and that's making them mad, or they are doing what everybody else is doing, and that's making them mad. They're at the cusp, in my opinion, to get the kind of leadership and support that they need to have so that they don't fall into that abyss. So anger, I think, is a big one, because most 15- and 16-year-olds are, as a rule, unless something's going on, pretty happy, pretty content to go play basketball, go ride a bike, swim all day, all those kind of things. They're, play video games even. They're pretty content to do things like that. But if you feel an intense anger coming from that kid, it's time to talk to them, in my opinion. In family, you've got starting arguments, breaking rules, or withdrawing from the family. Well, that's a part of the anger, but they don't use the word anger. School,
yeah.
Decreased interest, negative attitude, drop in grades, many absences, truancy, and discipline problems. Again, that's more anger. Social problems, new friends who are less interested in standard home and school activities, problems with the law, and changes to less conventional styles in dress and music. Some of the warning signs listed above can all be signs of other problems. Parents may recognize signs of trouble and possible use of alcohol and other drugs with their teenager. If you have concerns, you may want to consult a physician to rule out physical causes of the warning signs. I think that's good advice. This should often be followed or accompanied by a comprehensive evaluation by a child and adolescent psychiatrist and mental health professional. Depression in a, say, from 13 to 16 is very scary, because when a kid that age gets depressed, they do not know what to do with those emotions. They
right.
really do not. And they really, really, really need guidance then.
Right. And the one thing that's the scariest, like you just said, when a child that young feels depression, because they don't have a lot of life experience, they don't see light at the end of the tunnel. They don't know that it's temporary, that they're going to come out of it. And they're like, oh, my God, you know, like they feel that that's the way they're going to be for the rest of their lives. And they start having, awful thoughts about that they should be doing something so that they don't suffer. And that's why you have a lot of suicidal tendencies amongst children who get depressed, because they don't know that it's not going to be permanent. They don't know that there's a solution to make them not feel that bad.
Exactly. They just, what's wrong with
yeah.
them? They're just like, what's wrong with me? Why aren't I happy like everybody else? Why doesn't this feel like it used to feel when I got a new bike? Why don't I, you know, what happened to that old excitement and that old feeling of euphoria with the simple things? Mom's going to take everybody roller skating. When you were 13, you were, like, so excited about being able to go roller skating. Now, going roller skating doesn't mean anything to you. I don't care whether I go or not. You can go. I don't care. You know, when they get in that place, that's when they require the most help, and you understand that that's when they're looking for a way to pull themselves out, and that's when the bad decisions come in. When I got drunk, I had a hell of a good time. When I got high, everything was funny.
And that's also when they have a hard time verbalizing, because they're so disconnected that if you ask them what's wrong with you, they're going to say nothing, or because they really don't know. All they know is that they don't feel right, but they can't identify with it enough to articulate it. So it requires, yeah. really does require some assistance. You know, it's very difficult to to talk to a child that you know there's something not right with in order to get them to the point where they feel like talking back to you. So it is something I think parents need help with. And I think a lot of these agencies and organizations out there have suggested scripts. They do have some coaching available for parents or self-help groups. And I think it's important that if you have a child that's like non-communicative, that you can tell there's something not right. They're either angry or sad or not involved in the family anymore. And if you ask them what's wrong and they just keep saying nothing, 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 you can't just say, well, now they're just going through a phase. No, no, no. You've got to put out a little bit more effort and do some more research and find out how to talk to the child, because that's not normal. And it's not a phase, and if you don't deal with it, it can get worse and worse and worse until they're put in a position of, like what we're talking about, of fixing the problem themselves by turning to drugs or alcohol because they just don't want to feel that way. And while they're high, at least it gives them an artificial sense of control and happiness.
Well, and very sadly, once you've fallen into that, that stays with you forever, because I can sit here right now at age 65 and remember times in my, not in my youth so much, but like in my 30s, after the kids got old enough for Spike and I to have a life again and do things without the kids, you know, and drinking and partying with friends and things like that. We never used drugs, but we certainly did our share of drinking. And I have some really great memories of those times. I really do. I have stories in my head that I've shared with you, I've shared with other people. They're great of fun and frivolity, and they are usually under the influence of alcohol. And that now, it's elusive. Now, if I drink too much, I just feel like crap, and, you know, so it's not worth it to me, which I guess is lucky, because otherwise I could, my heritage, I absolutely positively could have been an alcoholic. So, but I still have those, you know, those times when I just had so much fun, dancing and singing and having great fun with people I loved and people that I had a lot in common with. So I can imagine, and this is only in my imagination, that the first time somebody gets stoned when they're 13 and it's great for them, that they go in search of that on many different roads. And the reason they do that is because they want to capture that fun again. So I get it. You know, I absolutely, positively get it. But I guess you have to be a certain age before you realize that that fun all was generated from you, not from the drug or the alcohol. It was generated from who you are, with less inhibitions, obviously, but it still came from you. So that's still in there.
Right.
Now, you know, the thing that I'm concerned about, and I don't know whether you've ever, have you ever read the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous show?
I think I did years ago. I had come across, yes, I have, but I don't remember it off the top of my head right now. But, yes, I have read the 12, but it was years ago, so I don't remember it anymore.
Well, I'm going to share them with everybody this morning, because I didn't remember. I know about them. I think I have read them before. I think I've had through my years of trying to be a friend to certain people, I have gone to AA meetings. I have supported other people who were struggling, but I didn't ever really remember sitting down and reading these and absorbing them.
Before you read them,
when
I took the addictionology course, one of the things I thought was fascinating on there is that it was actually borrowed from an ancient, I think it was in Greece or something like that, but it was a society outside the United States that had actually adopted these, that had created them more from a religious standpoint. And when the Alcoholics Anonymous got created, they actually took it and kind of modified it for use here in the United States. But they weren't the ones that created the 12 steps. And the only thing that the Addictionology Council completely disagrees with is the first statement, where people have to say they're completely powerless, because that's absolutely not the case. You know, you're only powerless while you're using drugs or alcohol, but when you make that decision to get clean, you have now regained your power, and you'll keep it as long as you stay proactive. So that the rest of it, I think, is pretty good, and we'll see as you read them. But I did want to point that out, that having people say they're powerless against anything is, as far as I agree with it, I think it's detrimental, because we're not powerless against anything.
Well, that's not the way it's written on the, what I found was service material from the General Service Office from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I guess there are variables in different places that print these lists, but this is the one that popped up more often than the rest, so that usually means that it's the most frequently used. It says, and it does say that on the first one, but it also says, it says, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. So I understand where you're coming from. What you just said makes sense to me, and I can see how somebody would look at that as
That's not what the original text said. Maybe that has been modified, because I have I did have a copy in that course of what the original book that was put out by the Alcoholics Anonymous, and it says I acknowledge that I am powerless against this disease. And that's why a lot of, maybe because of the Addictionology Council, they finally changed that wording to say they used to be powerless, which actually I do agree with that. I have no problem with them saying. But to say that in the current mode with their proactive activities that they're still powerless, that's what they were railing against, because they said it was completely the wrong message.
Well, so it has been a little bit reverbalized, because it doesn't offend me. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Number two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Number three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Now, and that's probably something that's been rewritten, because everybody, you know, there's all different beliefs. So the as we understood him is to cover that arena, I would guess. Number four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Now, that number four, like one of the most important things to assess about yourself. Number five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Number six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Now, I'd struggle with that one, because I, albeit my belief in God is great, I don't think he does any interventions for us. I think it's up to us. Seven, humbly ask him to our shortcomings. I also don't think, I don't think it's our right to take one thing and put it in another place where it's not your responsibility. I think everything should be your responsibility. But this has worked a long time, so I really have a lot of balls saying anything bad about it. So, but I'm just giving my opinions for what they're worth. Number eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I think that's good. I think that's important in everyday life. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible. except when to do so would injure them or others, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it, thought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry his message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all of our affairs. So I have a lot of mixed emotions about this, and part of it is probably because I won't let go of certain feelings that I have about religion and things like that. But I would say that this has worked for a very, very, very long time. Alcoholics Anonymous. I couldn't find an exact date. Have you ever read exactly how long Alcoholics Anonymous has been established and been doing this kind of work?
Actually, it's in my notes. I don't have them. I don't have them handy right now. But in the white paper that I had written, it was one of the facts that was discussed. And like I said, I actually have a document right now that has the original 12 steps and actually goes through the history of, like I said, because it wasn't started in the United States, of where they actually started. It goes back hundreds of years, actually, the original 12. And like I said, they were modernized. They were brought to the United States, and they were made more Christian based.
Mm-hmm.
And now it looks like they're trying to capture all religions. But at one time it was very Christian based. You know, and like I said, and I'm the same way with you. I have mixed emotions about this also, because I think religions that advocate more personal responsibility are better when people, and this is my opinion, I'm not preaching right now, but that's one of the reasons why I like the Essene religion so much, because it's also Christian-based, but it's all about personal responsibility, that Jesus didn't come here to save our souls. He came here to show us how to save our own souls, basically, and that's the premise. That's the one major difference between Essene Christianity and other forms of Christianity, is that it's like you're responsible for living a life of integrity, not for doing whatever you want to do and making all kinds of mistakes and then just saying, oh, I'm sorry and I believe in Christ and my soul will be saved. You know, you do have a responsibility to live a life of integrity and to make good choices. That doesn't mean if you screw up and make mistakes that there isn't some way of you fixing that. There always is. But what it does is it puts more of a day-to-day onus on people to be self-analytical, to look at their actions, to look at their choices, and to analyze them almost immediately. And part of the 12 steps seems to go there. It looks like they're saying that the person should be, you know, reviewing what they do, and if they find they've done something wrong, to, like, fix it right away. That's good. That's proactive. And that's more in line with being self-responsible. But I think that praying to a higher power, that could be your own higher power, because we all have a higher power within ourselves. And whether you want to call it God or your own higher power, the bottom line is we all do have that ability to summon up greater self-responsibility. And when we do, things start changing more positively for us.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I would agree with everything you just said. I did Google this while you've been talking. The timeline of Alcoholics Anonymous history is started in 1935, and I thought that it was longer ago than that for whatever reason. But wasn't 35? And when did Prohibition start?
That's a good question. I'm not. Sure, and I just recently saw something on it, too. I'm surprised I'm not remembering the time frame that was discussed. It was around maybe a little bit earlier than that, maybe around the 1920s.
Yeah.
I seem to remember when they had the old moonshiners and all that. When was all that? Because moonshining became prevalent because of the Prohibition.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not positive, but I think it was around, it was in the early 1900s. I'm not sure if it was 1920 or whatever, but yeah, it's all around that same time frame.
Prohibition in the United States was a nationwide ban on the sale, production, importation, and transportation of alcoholic beverages that remained in place from 1920 to 1933.
Okay.
The Dry Movement, led by rural Protestants in the Democratic and Republican parties, was coordinated by the Anti-Saloon League. Prohibition was mandated under the 18th Amendment to the United States Constitution, enabling legislations known as the Volstead Act, set down the rules for enforcing the ban and defined the types of alcoholic beverages that were prohibited. Private ownership and consumption of alcohol was not made illegal under federal law. However, in many areas, local laws were more strict, with some states banning possession outright. Nationwide prohibition ended with the ratification of the 21st Amendment, which repealed the 18th Amendment on December 5th, 1933. So, there's lots of legs.
On the 1920s, right? That's what I was remembering.
So, again, you know, a lot of this has, you know, has good memories for people. Again, I remember my mother-in-law saying to me one time, meaning my family and myself, my brothers and sisters, my parents, you all talk about drinking like you had the best time in the world. And I said, I guess we have. And even the stories of my parents when I wasn't drinking were usually funny, not outrageously sad or volatile or any of those kind of things. So in some respects, I was lucky with that, but I also think that when alcoholism affects a family and it's more, entertaining and jovial than harmful, then that's, of course, a lot of times when it becomes such a big habit in a family. I have talked to other adults in my lifetime and listened to their stories, and their stories of drinking were much more unkind than mine. And I think that has something to do with how you handle the rest of it. We're almost out of time, though, and I did want to touch base on this new thing that I'm going to be doing and let everybody know how powerful this can be, and that's the transitional living after you get control of your drug use or your alcoholism or whatever dependencies you have.
Tomorrow show with that so you can spend a few more minutes actually kind of detailing a little bit of it.
I'm going to, but I want to lay the groundwork because I think we're going to talk about this on Monday. Tomorrow
okay.
will be Wednesday, so we won't include it tomorrow. But on Monday, we're going to talk about transitional living, and it's the idea, which I have always been in favor of but didn't know how to organize it, and now it's being done all over the world, is transition
mm-hmm.
from in a detox to going back home, going back to where the whole problem originated, and
mm-hmm.
to just out of a detox and send you back there, a major act of futility. So I
right.
love the idea, and I see this idea as helping a lot more than people give it any credence for, and I want to talk about that at length. But we are just about out of time, but I want to say that if you are having these kind of problems and if your life is consumed with especially a young person who you know is immersed in the world of drugs and alcohol, please seek help. All you got to do is Google it. There's hundreds of places, and most of them accept your family insurance. So please seek some help. You can't do it by yourself, I promise you. I wish you could, but you cannot. So everybody have a great day, though. We'll be back tomorrow to do a little recap on the things that we talked about all week. And I want everybody to go out there and have a great day. Today is going to be very, very hot. So, and then our temperatures are dropping a little bit. So have a good one, everybody. God bless. Thanks, Shell. We will talk in a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. All right. Thanks, Renee. Have a wonderful day, everyone. Talk to you in the morning.
Bye-bye, everybody. God bless.